on campus for this lecture. So good evening and welcome to this new season of the lecture series at McGill University School of Architecture. My name is Aaron Sprecher. And in fact, I couldn't find a better plan than to start this season with our prestigious David Azraeli Lecture in Architecture. So I would like to thank you. Where are you? Oh, I would like to thank you, David and Stephanie, for giving us this opportunity to propel design knowledge across our architecture community here at McGill University and across the city. Our guest of tonight is Bjarke Ingels, and he will be introduced by our director, Anne-Marie Adams, in a few minutes. His lecture will be followed by closing remarks and questions from the audience, moderated by my colleague, Professor Martin Bressani. Yet before engaging with the provocative ideas of Bjarke Ingels and his firm, BIG, I have the pleasure to introduce our new dean at the Faculty of Engineering, Dean Jim Neisel. Dean Jim Neisel has, in fact, recently completed a six-year term as McGill Associate Vice Principal for University Services and was the Engineering Faculty Associate Dean of Student Affairs from 2001 to 2006. A chemical engineer and environmental engineer by training, Dean Neisel is the recipient of major awards, and his list of publication is literally endless. But most importantly, Dean Neisel loves buildings and architecture. During his term as Associate Vice Principal, he oversaw the development and implementation of McGill Master Plan, as well as the complex and time-constrained renovations to the McIntyre Medical, Automass Chemistry, and the McDonald Engineering buildings. All three projects were carried out as part of the government knowledge infrastructure program. So, Jim, and I don't know where you are. You are over there. So, Jim, we are honored by your presence tonight. Thank you very much. And thank you for accepting to share with us your great vision. So, on behalf of the lecture committee at the School of Architecture, I wish you all an inspiring evening. Please turn off the 600 cell phones and computers in this room. And please join me in welcoming Dean Jim Neisel. Thank you.
Thanks very much. This is actually truly an honor. This is my debut performance as Dean of Engineering. So, first of all, again, thank you, Aaron, for giving me the opportunity to say a few words. Town and gown, which is a term that's often used in university environments, is a term traditionally used to describe events like tonight's. That is, the coming together of academics and the broader community to share knowledge and expand the worldviews of both. At the Faculty of Engineering, this need for linkages to achieve mutually beneficial goals is not a fuzzy concept born in the Middle Ages or some shop-worn turn of phrase. It is a guiding principle of our very existence. And nowhere are our community-university interactions more evident than at our School of Architecture. Its students, its teachers, its researchers, and its programs are all nourished by the long-standing interface that the school has so vigorously pursued with Montreal, Quebec, Canadian, and the international communities. For that reason, I'm particularly pleased this evening to acknowledge the significant role that Dr. David J. Azraeli has played in fostering this principle of university-community collaboration, not only at McGill, but around the world. As an architect, entrepreneur, and philanthropist, he has worked throughout his life to promote access to education and the achievement of excellence in various fields, most notably in architecture and architectural education. McGill's Azraeli Lecture in Architecture is a sterling example of that goal. It is among the most prestigious architectural events in Montreal and indeed of all Canada. And it allows our architectural students to learn from and interact with some of the greatest architects on the planet. More importantly, in terms of impact on our students, David Azraeli is a role model in every sense of a term. A survivor of the Holocaust, he has had many new beginnings and in every instance he has emerged a winner. His latest architectural triumph reflects a steady determination to succeed. I refer, of course, to the spectacular Azraeli Center in Tel Aviv, the largest real estate project in Israel and Tel Aviv's greatest architectural landmark. If you have not yet seen the photos of the three high-rise towers at the heart of this project, then you really should take the time to do this. The buildings are very spectacular. These qualities of pragmatism and determination are the traits we admire most in Dr. Azraeli. They have fueled success after success and enabled him to use his achievements to advance the field he holds so dear, architecture. We are particularly appreciative, of course, of his involvement in architectural education, be it at Tel Aviv University, Carleton University, McGill University, or elsewhere. A modern-day Renaissance figure who values art every bit as much as entrepreneurial success, David Israeli has been a true leader in promoting a dialogue between the worlds of art and architecture, and he is with us here tonight. So please join me in extending a warm Montreal welcome to our patron this evening, Dr. David J. Israeli. I now ask Professor Anne-Marie Adams, the Director of McGill School of Architecture, to introduce tonight's guest speaker. Professor Adams.
Well, thank you very much, Aaron and Jim. It's my great privilege to welcome you all to the School of Architecture's 2014 lecture series, which we are kicking off in a very big way this year. Tonight's lecture, as you know, is Bjarke Ingels, who heads up the architectural firm Bjarke Ingels Group, or BIG, with offices in Copenhagen, New York, and Beijing. The second most important thing to say is that depending on how you count, three or four McGill architecture students have recently been employed there, for which we are very grateful. Yeah. Ingels was born in Copenhagen and studied at the Royal Academy in his hometown and subsequently at the Escuela Técnica Superior de Arquitectura in Barcelona, graduating in 1999. His career has literally skyrocketed since then, especially since the founding of BIG in 2005. The firm has drawn extensive national and international attention and won several international awards for its first completed commission, The Mountain, a residential project in Copenhagen. Over the next couple of years, following 2005, BIG received several large commissions around the world, including a waste-to-energy plant, which doubles as a ski slope in Copenhagen, W57, the West 57th Street apartment tower in New York, the National Gallery of Greenland, the headquarters for the Shenzhen Energy Company in Shenzhen, China, and the Granville Bridge Tower in Vancouver. This summer, it was announced that BIG won the competition to design Lego House, a quasi-museum visitor center set to open in 2016 in Billund, Denmark. My own personal favorite is the snowflake-shaped Elsinore Psychiatric Hospital in Helsingør, Denmark, designed in 2006 in Ingels' first firm, Plot. And a close second is the hilly walkable roof BIG has built over Ingels' former high school, Gamal Hillerup. He currently lives in New York to oversee BIG's projects in North America. Ingels has taught at Rice, Columbia, Harvard, and Yale. As architects go, Ingels is unquestionably a media darling and likely the world's youngest starchitect. In September 2012, his relatively short career was the subject of a 14-page profile in The New Yorker. In 2011, the Wall Street Journal named him Innovator of the Year. His extraordinary media presence is likely connected to both his sheer accessibility and his photogenic architecture. Both contribute to his optimistic position on the power of architecture. Most of us will know his delightful 2009 book, Yes is More, presented in graphic novel format. At 400 pages, Yes is More is short form for Ingels' theory of utopian pragmatism, which proudly positions itself between what he calls the naivete of the avant-garde and the predictable, boring boxes of real life. Yes is More architecture is about affirmation, about reimagining whole building types and giving clients something they never imagined. Hence, BIG's work is recognizable by its sheer aspiration and innovation rather than any particular formal characteristics, though he clearly likes both curves and loops, both part of his Danish pavilion for Shanghai World Expo, possibly the world's first building to be experienced by bike. As journalist Ian Parker in The New Yorker attested, Ingalls excels at relaxed storytelling and firmly believes that making buildings is what an architect should do. He sees the art of communication as a crucial aspect of the design process and admits he's an extrovert as far as architects go. One of my favorite parts of that New Yorker article is where Ingalls explains to Parker something he learned from film director Charlie Kaufman, quote, "You are what you love, not just what loves you." And luckily for us, Bjark Ingalls loves architecture.
Excellent introduction. It's hard. It's going to be hard to follow sort of the opening act. There was someone who's going to shut down the lights eventually. But it's a pleasure to be here at McGill, and thank you to Mr. Azraeli and Mrs. Azraeli for donating the lecture. Actually, I came across the Azraeli Center on Wikipedia 2 days ago because I was trying to wiki the definition of prismatic geometry, and the Azraeli Center was there as an example. So it has already earned immortality in Wikipedia. I was thinking, since this is an architecture school, it could be interesting to talk a little bit about architecture and the role of architecture. Obviously, I come from the architecture office big. We were 2 years ago incorporated in America, and to celebrate it, we had a themed summer party that was called Big Ink, and everybody had to make tattoos. And then the award for the best, and in this case not a tattoo, it was like Lauren. She went all in. It grew out after 6 weeks. So basically, we've been around in Copenhagen for the last 13 years, and recently we moved into this space. It's a former Carlsberg factory where they used to make the least interesting part of the beer, the bottle cap. And we're having our housewarming party on the 4th of October there. And then also we moved to America 3 years ago. And if you talk a little about what could be the role of architecture or of the architect in society, I think you know, what's interesting about architects is that you can't really say we have any significant power in sort of over our physical environment. We don't have any political power to decide that this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it. And we neither have the financial power to actually pay for our experiments. So the only thing we have is the power of our ideas. And in group psychology, you talk about naturally emerging leadership happens with the one individual in the group who manages to better than anyone else formulate a vision that captures the demands and desires and concerns of everyone else in the group. So in a way, if we as architects are capable of actually listening and observing what are the tendencies, what are the desires, what are the potential conflicts, what are the potential sort of requests and concerns and demands and criteria that surround a project, we actually have the possibility to put forward a shared vision that better than anyone else captures the concerns and demands of everybody in surrounding the project. And through this power of distilling all of the aspects of society into concrete ideas, we can actually exercise influence. And I think if you look at, architecture shouldn't be sort of just the art of designing pretty facades or exciting sculptures. It should almost be the art of designing our cities and buildings as man-made ecosystems, where we channel not only the flow of people, but also the flow of resources through our cities and buildings. I like to sort of show this photo as a way of one of the indications that the role of architecture could maybe be expanding. This was a photo taken at the United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Copenhagen 3 years ago. And as you can see on the faces of, I think, every single world leader, but especially Sarkozy, it wasn't exactly a party. It was a complete failure, and none of the goals that had been established for the World Summit were reached. And the general discussion about sustainability was drowning in this, I think, very general misconception that sustainability is a question of how much of our current quality of life are we willing to sacrifice in order to afford becoming sustainable. So when we got invited to design the Danish Pavilion for the Shanghai World Expo in China in 2010, we thought it could be interesting, and the subject was sustainable cities, it could be interesting to try to come with another take on sustainability. What if sustainable cities and buildings could actually increase our quality of life and our enjoyment of the city? So to cut a long story short, we tried to condense various aspects of Danish city life into a single pavilion. So the pavilion was conceived as a loop of a Danish cityscape complete with the blue bicycle lanes of Denmark, the city bikes of Copenhagen that we've had for now almost 20 years. So trying to remind people with a physical experience, like the joy of riding a bicycle through the city instead of being stuck in a traffic jam or looking endlessly for a parking spot. You could also bicycle through the exhibition itself, making it the ideal museum for impatient people, because you could do the whole thing in 3 minutes without missing an exhibit. One of our first projects in Copenhagen was the Copenhagen Harbor Bath that we built in 2002. That essentially, because the port water of Copenhagen has become so clean, you can swim in it. So we sort of extended public life into the water itself. And to bring this experience to China, we made a harbor bath where the visitors could experience how clean, if not how cold, Danish harbor water is. And finally, we were thinking, this is not going to be much of a game changer if nobody goes there. So we thought, how could we attract all of the Chinese to come and experience this on their own bodies, the thrill of biking and swimming in the middle of the city? And we found that in the public school curriculum of China, they have three fairy tales by Hans Christian Andersen, which means that all 1.4 billion Chinese grew up with the story of Little Mermaid, the national symbol of Denmark. So we proposed to move the mermaid to China for 6 months. When the Danish Nationalist Party, which would be like the Tea Party of Denmark, heard about this, they tried to pass a law specifically against moving a mermaid. I had to go to Parliament to argue her case. But as you can see, we actually got her. Then we had to get her through Chinese customs and into the pavilion. In her absence, we reached out and invited the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei to make an installation. What he did was that he installed a Chinese surveillance camera in the pavilion. It's the same brand of camera that the Chinese state has installed in front of his studio. But this one was transmitting a live image to an installation he mounted in Copenhagen, where the mermaid normally sits. He called it the Mermaid Exchange, so tourists who would go in vain could see that she was okay, just 6 hours ahead in time zone. In a way, politically, it became like a loophole in the Great Firewall of China, because for 6 months it was the only uncensored live TV feed from China to the rest of the world. But essentially, the pavilion was one of the first times where we tried to materialize this idea of hedonistic sustainability, that sustainable cities and buildings can actually be more enjoyable than their less sustainable alternatives. And you can say, like, the way we try to work is what you could call knowledge-driven design, that we try to identify, whenever we have a task at hand, we try to identify what are the specific expertises, what are the specific elements of knowledge, what is the information that we need to extract from the situation to inform our design decisions. So in a way, our buildings end up expressing the conditions that have shaped them. I like this idea that architecture is a little bit like portraiture. Because the success of a portrait, when an artist is painting a portrait of someone, it's a bit like designing a building for someone, a client or a user group or an organization. You can say the success of the portrait is in the artist's capacity to express him or herself as an artist, but maybe more importantly, in the artist's capacity to express not only the physical appearance of the subject, but also the personality, the character, the aura, the soul, if you like, of the subject. Every time you are designing a building for a specific situation, you have the possibility to capture not only the sort of the objective constraints, but also some of the more invisible conditions that surround the project. And I think the art that tends to interest me the most is art pieces that expand your perception of the world. It could be a piece of literature that captures elements of life that you would normally disregard as mediocre, and it just sort of shows the potential for meaning. Or it could be a piece of music that captures noises that you would normally just disregard as background and shows the potential for harmony. But I think the important thing is that once someone has, described a story or has made you hear the harmony in certain sounds, you won't be able to hear these sounds again without actually seeing the potential for harmony in them. So in a way, it expands your perception of the world. And in the same way, in architecture, instead of ignoring what surrounds the project, you actually have the possibility to almost draw the contours of the flow of events that is already happening in a site and that could happen. A great urban intervention will show you possibilities in the city or in a building that you never thought possible before. But once you've seen it, you won't be able to think of the world again without this possibility being latent. So in a way, what I'd like to do now is try to show you a handful of the work we've been doing over the last decade and try to show you what were the specific pieces of information or the observations that ended up shaping those buildings into what they are. Some of our first work in Copenhagen was the VM House and a project called The Mountain. The Mountain was conceived as this sort of hybrid of a parking structure, 200,000 square feet of parking, and 100,000 square feet of apartments. Instead of following the master plan that would dictate a slab of apartments looking at a big boring block of cars, we thought, like, why don't we turn all of the apartments into penthouses and put them on a podium of cars, almost like a man-made hillside. We sloped it to the south. We chopped up the building volume because I have an apartment in the VM House right next to it, and we didn't want to block the view from my apartment. The parking occupies all of the deep space on the ground, the apartments somehow combine the splendors of a suburban lifestyle, a house with a garden, but with a penthouse view and a dense urban location. So it really becomes this sort of man-made mountain, 11 floors, almost like an homage to the 1967 Habitat by Moshe Safdie, but sort of made possible by putting it on top of a parking structure. You have these sort of houses with gardens, this sort of suburban lifestyle. Children can run out and play, even though it's in the middle of the dense city. This is made possible because it's sitting on top of the cars. You have a single funicular elevator that gives access to all of the apartments. Facing the city is the parking structure, and we wanted to make it naturally ventilated and naturally illuminated So it's wrapped in this aluminum facade with different sizes of holes, because we always refer to the project as the mountain, Bjerget. The name means the mountain in Danish. We ended up commissioning this Japanese Himalaya photographer, and because the holes look dark on the bright aluminum, from a distance, the entire facade becomes this giant artwork, 30,000 square feet, that is completely for free, because what makes the building look like a mountain is also what makes it breathe and makes it naturally illuminated. So these principles, we call it architectural alchemy, that by mixing traditional ingredients like parking and apartments in a new mixture, you can actually create added value. We took one step further for a project for the same client in the outskirts of Copenhagen. This lake is really where Copenhagen City stops and a park takes over. It's going to be part of a big, dense new neighborhood built along the subway. And you literally have like other life forms on the other side of the lake. And what we thought was, like, when you're building a new neighborhood from scratch, how do you give it the diversity and the liveliness and the surprises of a historical neighborhood? You know, where nothing is, you have to come with everything else, but also where nothing is, everything is possible. So we looked at the program. It's 120,000 square feet of shops and offices. They want to be close to the customers on the ground. On top, a layer of residences. But because residential floor plates are less deep than commercial floor plates, we get space for little townhouses. Then we add a layer of more classic apartments, and then penthouse townhouses with little gardens and a small path in front. The master plan asks for a shortcut through the site, so we turn it into a figure eight, creating these plazas that connect through the building. And finally, shops and offices, they like daylight, but they don't like sunshine and glare. They spend energy on cooling. So to the south, we lower the offices to the ground. And to the north, we create a four-story office building that also lifts up the apartments into the view and the sun. And finally, in reverse, in the southwest corner, we lower the building to the ground, opening up the entire courtyard for the sun and the view over the landscape. And as a result, we get this sort of distorted figure eight that actually creates a gigantic a sort of mountain path along these townhouses that takes you all the way from the ground to the roof. So you can say this idea of architectural alchemy doesn't only allow us to optimize the conditions for the individual programs, like lifting up the townhouses into the sun, providing natural shade for the offices, but it also allows for sort of an expansion of the social realm in the city. That traditionally, the possibility for social life or the creation of a community is restricted to occurring at the street on the ground floor. But here it's actually sort of invited to invade the three-dimensional space of the urban block. So the eight house is not just a pretty facade or a funky sculpture. It's really a three-dimensional urban condition where people can really get to know each other all the way from the ground to the penthouse. Sort of to extend this sort of three-dimensional idea where the eight house crosses itself. We consolidated all of the amenities in this vertical space that sort of bounces all the way from the ground to a shared roof terrace. And also, you end up getting this sort of, you know, Copenhagen is completely flat. This is the topography you have to work with. So there's no way to enjoy the view of your city, and actually people really come out to the eight house to sort of experience the only view you can actually get of the city you live in from an outdoor space, which is this sort of man-made extension to the landscape of Copenhagen. So like quite often I get this sort of objection that this only works in sort of semi-socialist Scandinavia, that in the real world this would be impossible. But there has actually been sort of Danish architecture, Danish modern architecture is actually very much informed by certain breakthroughs in the Americas. If you look at the Hotel Royal by the Danish architect Arne Jacobsen from the 60s, it's like very much inspired by, for instance, the Gordon Bunshaft Lever House from the 50s. Jørn Utzon, the great hero of Danish architecture, did a lot of projects like the Silkeborg Art Museum. That it's not a copy, but it's definitely inspired in many ways by its predecessor, the Guggenheim Museum, or like looking at Frank Lloyd Wright, Jørn Utzon's Lange Linje Pavilion, and the Johnson Wax Tower by Frank Lloyd Wright. And of course, the Sydney Opera, again, inspired, not copied, but clearly sort of influenced in a way by Eero Saarinen's TWA Terminal. And Eero Saarinen was actually on the jury for the competition for the Sydney Opera. So there's like more than one relationship. And even if you look at some of the sort of Danish modern classics in furniture, the Eames lounge chair somehow informed the ant, but Arne Jacobsen wanted to see if he could do it with just a single plywood shell. And also if you look at the shell chair and the egg chair, they're clearly sort of siblings, or like there's relationships. And I think in that sense, I think one of the interesting sort of evolutionary aspects of design and architecture is that there is actually an exchange of ideas, and if you sort of stand on the shoulders of your predecessors, you can actually reach much higher. Because nobody would accuse Arne Jacobsen of having ripped off the shell chair, but it's like definitely a classic in its own right. But probably it wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for the Eames. So recently, since a lot of Danish architecture has been inspired by America, now we got a chance to somehow bring some of the Scandinavian attitudes back to the U.S. We got invited by the Manhattan developer Durst to look at a site on the west side of Manhattan, an amazing site overlooking the west, with views of the Hudson, but also surrounded by a power plant, a sort of a waste facility garage, and the West Side Highway. So we thought, like, what they really need in this sort of part of New York that's called Hell's Kitchen is that they need somehow an urban oasis. And this is the courtyard building from Copenhagen where my dad grew up. And in a way, you can say the Copenhagen courtyard is at the architectural scale what Central Park is at the urban scale, this oasis in the middle of the city. So we thought, like, what happens when you combine skyscraper with courtyard? Or what could a court scraper look like? So we basically we placed the courtyard on the site next to a tower called the Helena. It's not only owned by our client, it's also named after his daughter. So we did everything to preserve the views from the Helena. But then to give it Manhattan density, we've lifted up the northeast corner to 470 feet. But still sort of tilting towards the southwest, so you have both the sunlight all of the day and views over the Hudson. So it ends up creating this striking new silhouette on the west side waterfront of Manhattan. Depending on where you see it from, it becomes like almost like a spire, or geometrically it's a hyperbolic paraboloid, a ruled surface. From the east, it becomes really like a spire in its own right. And when you enter, you go through the lobby up into this big courtyard that actually has exactly the same proportions as Central Park, only it's 15,000 times smaller. And because of the asymmetry of the Durst Pyramid, as it's been nicknamed, you actually, like, all of the residents and everybody in the courtyard actually has views over the Hudson and the sunset, including all of the houses that have terraces sunken into the roof. So it's currently under construction, and if everything goes according to schedule, in 2 years, this could be the experience of driving up and down the West Side Highway. Do you have the sound?
Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the narrow, but I'll be hooked forever. I'm the new Sinatra, and since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem, all of my Dominicanos right there on Broadway. Pull me back to that McDonald's, took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like the Simmons with the pastry. Statue of Liberty, long live the World Trade, long live the King, yo. I'm from the Empire State.
So, and I was sort of testing the speakers here at the auditorium. Since we've moved to North America, we've sort of gotten the opportunity to try typologies that are completely alien to Scandinavia. And actually, the first thing that happened after coming here in October 2010, I went to speak at the Urban Land Institute in Vancouver, and I met a developer, Ian Gillespie, and we had like a really good conversation. And then I mentioned, oh, by the way, we just opened an office in New York. And he said, ah, so you're here. And I think that's quite indicative of North America, because like I had just gotten off a plane traveling 7 hours from New York, three time zones away in another country on another ocean, and still the feeling was, ah, you're here, so we can do stuff. Ian had a site right at the Granville Bridge that was being tortured by the trifalking of the bridge itself, slicing it up into these like very difficult triangles. So we just started mapping all of the constraints, the setbacks from the streets, the setback from the bridges, a 100-foot setback, because the city wants to secure that nobody looks straight into heavy traffic, another setback to make sure we don't cast shadows on the neighboring park. And finally, we were left with this sort of tiny 6,000-square-foot footprint, almost too small to develop, and that was the root of the challenge. But then we try to think, like, so the reason for the 100-foot setback had to do with ensuring a minimum distance. So we thought, like, if we get 100 feet up in the air, we can actually come back out and reclaim the lost area, make a 12,000-square-foot rectangular floor plate, maximizing all of the nicest apartments. So it's almost like when you drive over Granville Bridge, it becomes like, as if someone is pulling a curtain aside, sort of welcome to Vancouver. Almost like a genie coming out of a bottle in a sort of very dense urban situation. So it really reminded us of the Flatiron, because the Flatiron is a product of this moment in Manhattan real estate history where the accumulated real estate value combined with steel structure and elevators suddenly made an undevelopable triangular site into this sort of striking landmark that has now become the namesake of a whole neighborhood in Manhattan. Except we are taking the Flatiron idea one step further. We try to nickname it the Fatiron, but the client hates it. And at the base, like from the bridges and down, you can have shops, offices, restaurants, galleries. So we made this sort of village of programs, and we're trying to use the space under the bridges. If you know the climate of Vancouver, being under the canopy of a big bridge might actually be nice for the public realm. And also because Vancouver has all of these rather significant photo artists, we're trying to look at this idea of making sort of a street version of the Sistine Chapel, sort of by making the underside of the bridge into this upside-down art gallery of photo art, these like light boxes that a lot of the photo artists use in the beginning. So this project has been approved and is moving ahead. And just as a sort of strange coincidence, for the same client, West Bank, but for another project, and for TELUS, the cell phone company in Calgary, we're doing a project that is almost like the Vancouver Tower turned upside down. And it's not just because we are running out of ideas. The thing is, like, and we actually had like a lot of doubts about whether or not this made sense, because we could clearly see that it's not exactly the same upside down, but there is definitely something to it. But here, it's a completely different situation. It's Calgary is this sort of corporate downtown. I actually knew Calgary from the movie Way Downtown, about these office workers that try to see how long they can live without exiting into the outdoors, and like gradually everybody goes nuts. But because of the like all of Calgary is connected with this network, 15 feet above ground, I think Montreal has something quite similar.
But essentially, Calgary is very much like a corporate downtown with sort of a residential suburb. And what TELUS and Westbank wanted to do was to try to sort of combine the two typologies into a single building to have a resident population in the downtown area. And the basic idea is that the offices want to be an efficient maximum floor plate, 25,000 feet per floor. And then, of course, the apartments wants to be like a skinny slab with a lot of daylight and even like with balconies. But TELUS also wanted these two buildings to look as a single tower, so it could be the TELUS Tower. And essentially, that's this gradual transition from a skinny residential tower to a more efficient floor plate of an office tower. So that's essentially like a different kind of logic that almost creates this sort of upside down Vancouver silhouette. And the two projects, we're actually doing them now sort of synchronized. They'll be starting construction and completed at the same time. And now that we're starting to look into the materials of it, you can see that it's this sort of smooth office facade that gradually becomes a textured residential facade. At the ground, you sort of enter under the sort of the skirt of the curtain wall, and then you have sort of a series of programs. TELUS has like a sky lobby. There's a giant roof garden and a winter garden at the top. And the residences have these sort of classic apartment layouts with private balconies. But essentially, you can really see that the smooth, efficient office facade gradually becomes this sort of textured residential facade. And I think as a bonus, like the director, the CEO of TELUS, he sees TELUS as a very feminine company. And Calgary is like the Houston of Canada. You have cowboys and oil, and he like a lot of the towers are sort of petroleum headquarters of various oil-related companies. And he said he invited us to think of the project as a lady standing in a group of cowboys, and I think because of the residential slimness at the top, it really looks like the thinnest tower in this sort of rather bulky skyline of these big tower, office towers. So essentially this idea that how sort of the same client and like sort of rather different programmatic constraints can actually lead to sort of this sort of almost like upside down designs. I think when it comes to high rises, which is really the first time we started doing this here in, after we moved here, we got invited to by a client to go and see the Space Needle in Seattle and see if we could come up with something like that for Phoenix. Because he had been looking into like ways, because he had found out basically that the Space Needle in Seattle makes $20 million per year in elevator rides. So he saw it almost as a cash machine. And what you need to make a Space Needle work is that you need a city where there's actually a view when you get up. You have like the desert and the mountains in Phoenix. And then there should be no existing landmark. And I think Phoenix totally qualifies. So the idea is, in a way, to invent the Eiffel Tower for Phoenix. So we try to think, like, one of the things that we notice when you go up into these Space Needles is that the experience when you get up there is rather two-dimensional. It's like a rather flat sort of observation deck. And like one of the greatest inventions of American architecture is the dynamic spatial experience of the Guggenheim atrium, where you take the elevator up to the top, and then you have this sort of amazing sort of three-dimensional contemplation of a central void. So we thought, like, what if we turn the Guggenheim Museum inside out, sort of create this sort of all of the different programs of the Space Needle into a single sort of sphere, almost like dropping a Google pin into the map of Phoenix. So basically, you have like an elevator ride that takes you to the North Pole of this planet, and then you move down and enjoy the view of the surrounding city. So that's basically the idea. You take the elevator out on the exterior, so the column is as thin as possible. You also get the sort of the thrill of going all the way from underground up into this like a heavenly body. Then you sort of arrive at the North Pole. You have these great terraces on the top. And then as you sort of move your way down, you get this sort of dynamic interference between the horizontal horizon of Phoenix and the sort of sloping horizon of the building itself. The ET moment. And since this is a project that is exclusively built for fun in the middle of the desert, we try to find ways to make it as reasonable environmentally as possible. So, of course, like the compact shape of the sphere minimizes the external envelope. The consistent use of self-shading and the overhangs maximize the self-shading of the structure. We're using a thermoactive slab, so we're letting cold air in by night. We have exposed concrete on the floor, on the core, and on the ceiling that sort of radiates cool during the day. We have like really generous ceiling heights up to 20 feet, 20 feet floor to floor. So we can actually have warmer air at the top while retaining a comfort zone at the bottom. And then finally, photovoltaics in Phoenix, the sun is shining constantly. And we were thinking maybe, and there's the science center and the convention center right next to the tower. So we actually proposed to take the 30,000 square feet of photovoltaics that it takes to power the building and place them, this is the Phoenix flag, but essentially to commission an artist, because normally this kind of stuff would never be seen by anyone, but here we can guarantee that 700,000 people would be able to admire this this artwork from the sky every year. And of course, when you're designing a building that could become the landmark of a city, you have to like test the potential nicknames. Like now they actually call it the Big Pin, so we even managed to sneak our name into it as well. But also the Honey Dipper has been a popular nickname. And I think both nicknames are kind of sympathetic. So the client has established a collaboration with the Science Center, and reportedly we are 90% financed. So who knows? In 2 or 3 years, this could be the view when you arrive in Phoenix. A sort of last project, which is actually going to be the first project that we're building in America, is in Coconut Grove. A completely different situation, this sort of amazing jungle-like nature, the sort of the typical Miami apartment types with the big balconies. And of course, the view in this case overlooking the water is a major driver. And here our client was very concerned about that the towers would become like front and back, like a good tower and a bad tower. So we tried to proportion the tower so that on the lower floors, because of the 4 to 10 story neighbors, the most blatant direction towards the water is towards Bayshore Drive. But when you get higher up, the direct view of the water is actually at a slight angle. So then the two towers turn, so instead of being front and back, they become side by side, looking straight over the water instead of straight towards the street. And this basic sort of manipulation, you know, they're side by side, but they still don't block each other's views, of course. But essentially, it just meant that he could actually sort of deliver two towers of equal value. Structurally, the core is reinforced with a sheet of steel, so the columns can actually take all of the gravity loads and follow the turning of the building. So you have these like incredible sloping columns. And then basically the buildings are sitting in this sort of man-made landscape that incorporates all of the podium functions, the parking, the pool, into this topography of a man-made jungle. The landscape architect is called Raymond Jungles. And then basically the core and the columns are exposed in situ cast concrete, so like exposing the bones of the building. And then basically everywhere we try to sort of maximize the relationship with the outside. It's one of these like rare occasions where we have 12-foot ceilings. 12 feet is the tallest hurricane-proof sliding door you can get. So everything is just designed to sort of maximize the experience of the surroundings. And they're currently under construction. It's going to be our first completed building here in North America. So as you can see, even though a lot of the work, basically all the work I've showed you so far has been private developer commissions, but I think in many ways what we try to do, regardless of the private and essentially profit-oriented focus of any private development, we try to sort of maximize the project's generosity towards the public realm. In some projects, we've been publicly commissioned. One of our first projects was the Maritime Youth Center in Copenhagen, where we try to make the roof into this publicly accessible informal playground right on the waterfront. It also allowed us to move the building all the way to the water's edge. Normally, you have to have a 15-meter setback, but the city sees the whole building as public space, so we could also scoot it closer to the water. But in one case, we actually took the idea of public participation to sort of an extreme level, almost like surrendering authorship to the public participation process. And it started, these are images taken in front of our office in Copenhagen. Some of you might remember that Denmark had a so-called cartoon crisis because a right-wing provincial newspaper commissioned 10 cartoonists in some sort of misconceived crusade for liberty of speech to show that in Denmark we can make fun of everything, including the Prophet Muhammad. So they pissed off like a billion Muslims worldwide. Normally, you know, we saw images of Islamic demonstrators burning the Danish flag. It's an honor normally reserved for the American flag. And also, this was our office in Copenhagen. All of these young boys have an Islamic background, and they freaked out and started burning trash cans and cars. So around the same time, we got invited to look at a competition for making a 1 kilometer long urban space in our neighborhood in Copenhagen. And this neighborhood is the most ethnically diverse neighborhood in all of Denmark. There's more than 60 different nationalities living there. And we decided, I'll only explain one aspect of the project, but essentially we turned it into what we called the Red Square, where everything is red, including the gables. Different shades of red indicating different functions, even the bicycle lanes we could make red. The black market, where everything is black. And the black market rolls over the green hills and becomes this sort of green park where even the bicycle lanes are going to be green. And then we thought, as a way to sort of tap into this sort of ethnic diversity of the neighborhood, we actually reached out to the local community, asking people to nominate elements of their other home country, because it would be strange if the Danes had designed the only great bench and the only great lamp and the only great trash can for public space. So we basically asked people to nominate elements from their other home country that could sort of enrich the neighborhood. And the idea is that we didn't specify, you know, we don't eat Chinese food or Indian food to be nice to the Indians. It's because sometimes we want curry or... and it's the same, like, we didn't specify a Moroccan fountain to be nice to the Moroccans, but because the Moroccans have an amazing tradition of architectural water features, so now we have a Moroccan fountain on the black market in Copenhagen. Like, from Jamaica, we introduced this outdoor sound system where you can plug in your iPhone and make a spontaneous concert. And it's actually designed so that it cannot play high, like louder than the maximum allowed levels, and then it shuts off at 9 p.m. So it's like completely safe against complaints. And the idea is that almost like an outdoor art exhibition, there's these plates that says in the local language and in Danish what it is and where it's from. So we actually have 120 objects. There's a Thai boxing arena from Thailand, obviously. We have these playthings from India, swings from Iraq, like a whole muscle beach from Turkey. The litter boxes, cast iron from England, of course, bollards from Ghana. Even when you look at, like, of course, it's Denmark, we need bicycle racks everywhere. These ones are from Finland in rainbow colors. The sign on the Red Square is actually the sign from the Red Square in Moscow. Like, even down to the bus stops, this is a way more funky bus stop than what you normally see in Copenhagen. This one is from Kazakhstan. We found this sliding elephant in Ukraine. We actually had to make a copy of it because the original was from Chernobyl and it was radioactive. Like even down to the manhole covers, this is from France, from Switzerland, and from Israel, because a great part of the immigrant population is Islamic background, a lot of them from Palestine. We chose an object from Israel that is indestructible. It's like a one-inch cast iron manhole cover. We even found palm trees in China that grow in a Danish climate, so now we have naturally growing palm trees in Copenhagen. The octopus is like the ideal display of the diversity because all the children on it, you can just see they sort of represent every single shade of human. And like when you look at the benches, it becomes like a sort of a cultural study. From Mexico, an S-curved love seat where you look the person you're sitting next to into the eyes. From Belgium, a bench where everybody looks away from each other. And sort of, so like you have like this sort of great variety of ways of sort of inhabiting the public space on display. Even down to the lights, actually one of the main reminders that you're in a foreign culture when you travel is the advertisement. So as a series of like colorful sculptural lamps, we have advertisement for things you can't buy in Denmark. So this is obviously the sort of the peak of North American culture. Also Osborne the Bull from Spain. My favorite, a dentist from Qatar. Of course, on the Red Square, a series of elements from former Soviet or communist countries. And we actually, together with Superflix and Topotec, the landscape architects and the artist group, we made an app. So when you go, you can actually get the story behind of all of the different objects and understand what it is, where it's from, and why was it proposed and installed. So just purely looking at the sort of the social success of the project, it has been like a tremendous success and is very much accepted by the local community. Obviously, a project like this is very much about national identity. And we've done another project that deals very much with national identity, namely the identity of Greenland. Greenland recently became independent. And the first building they wanted to build with autonomy should be the National Art Museum of Greenland. And it's located on the waterfront of the beautiful rocky shores of Nuuk. And as if you see here, this is the context. These are like social housing built by the Danes, moving fishermen from their villages into big apartment blocks that completely ignore the landscape. Instead, we try to actually make the smallest possible courtyard gallery, a circle that follows the topography, almost like a melted circle. It is impregnated by the landscape of Greenland. And the introverted circle, because it melts, it suddenly captures the view of the surrounding landscape. You know, it follows the topography and lifts up to make a generous entrance. You have this like Guggenheim-esque painting gallery or picture gallery that takes you down to the main galleries on a single level, overlooking the sculptural courtyard. And I think this is sort of the main idea of the project, because like what happens is that once you get in to this sort of courtyard, the melted geometry creates a framed view where you can see the fjords and the mountains, the icebergs, the plants, and all of the sculptures and art pieces of Greenland. But all of the sort of social housing built by the Danes has been completely eliminated from view. So it becomes sort of an oasis of Greenlandicness in the middle of a city completely, almost completely erected by the Danish authorities. A last sort of category of projects that I'd like to talk about is what you could call sort of a, what we like to call social infrastructure, which is essentially that it seems to be almost like a law of nature that the infrastructure of the industry or even the military of the past gets reinvented to become the framework for the social and cultural life of the present. And I think you see this, you know, the Tate Modern in England, their most successful art museum, is a former power plant. The High Line in New York is a former train line that has now become the most popular park in New York City. And even like when you look at like things like the same in fashion, you know, that all the inventions, all the innovations come from military uniforms or sports clothes or workwear, and then, you know, the sneakers and the jeans, and then they get sort of adopted into the fine arts or the fashion. And it's very much a similar situation in architecture, that what starts as infrastructure suddenly becomes something else. One example, one of our first examples of looking at this was we got invited to look at making a Danish maritime museum in Copenhagen at Kronborg Castle, Prince Hamlet's castle. And Kronborg had become UNESCO World Heritage. So they had to kick out the Danish Maritime Museum that used to be inside the great halls of the castle, because when Hamlet was around, it was not a museum, it was his home. And as a suggestion, they said, where can we put it? Well, we have this decommissioned dry dock where they used to build ships. Maybe we can put it inside the dry dock. It was full of water, it was completely ruined, so we had to like refurbish it substantially. But we were thinking the museum program was practically twice the size of the dock itself. So we thought, like, rather than creating this sort of claustrophobic underground museum, completely drowned with museum program, if we could keep it open and empty, it could be almost like a public void sunken below the level of the sea. Also, the structural report said that the dock was in such a bad condition that we would have to reinforce it from the inside or with new dock walls on the outside. And we thought, if we're going to make new dock walls anyway, why don't we leave space enough to actually accommodate the museum program between the new and the old dock walls, in a way turning the museum brief inside out, leaving the dock as a big void sunken into the quay. It also became the perfect answer to the dilemma, because UNESCO said that we couldn't stick as much as a meter out of the ground to not disturb the UNESCO castle. But of course, the museum directors wanted some kind of an architectural masterpiece that could attract people to come and visit. And by turning it into a void, we could sort of combine the sort of allure of a big sunken void with the complete invisibility. So essentially, all we had to do was design a series of bridges to take people down into the museum, become shortcuts for the galleries or auditoria or restaurants, and also bring daylight into this completely underground museum. So we won the competition and started doing the refurbishment. Actually, the client got sued by our competitors in the competition, because one of the conditions of the brief was that the museum had to be inside the dock, and by definition, our museum was all around the dock. But happily, the client had gotten so convinced by the idea that they decided to cancel the competition and hire us as their architects. And essentially also because we are on the water, all of the bridges have been made in a shipyard and have been sailed to the site and lifted in like these giant pieces of steel bridges, exactly the way you make ships. So in a way, the architecture of the museum really becomes the concrete dock where they used to build ships, and the steel bridges that are actually made like ships. You see the auditorium and the exhibition crisscrossing each other, and the restaurant. So these photos are from this winter, and actually, if everything goes according to plan, we'll open the museum on my birthday, the 2nd of October this year. So we are incredibly busy. When I prepared this presentation, I also realized that it seems strange that everything we're doing in Denmark is underground. We recently completed a sports hall for my old high school. And the basic dilemma was that the only place you could put, it's a handball arena, like a multi-use sports hall. The only place you could fit it was on the sports fields where they play football. And that would be a crime against the culture of the place. So the only other place was actually to put it inside the courtyard of the high school to sort of let it stick out almost like a man-made molehill in the courtyard. And we got the commission from my old math teacher. And the rules of handball is that you need 4.5 meters of clearance on the sides and 8 meters in the middle. So we just based the geometry of the hall on the mathematical formula for a ballistic arch. So essentially the undulating roof is actually completely sort of shaped by the mathematics or the geometry of the sport itself, and it reflects as this sort of lazy hill in the courtyard. It has the height of a bench all along the perimeter, and it actually become this sort of giant social furniture. It has tripled the use of the courtyard, so it's really been sort of accepted. Like, we thought it was going to maybe occupy too much of the courtyard, but in fact it's really made it much more inviting. We place these little pieces of furniture. Also, the canteen is actually already in the basement, so we made a new main entrance that goes straight into the canteen and then continues into the sports hall. And in a way, this sort of organic curvature, you have like daylight falling down along the concrete walls. We have no paint finishes, so the concrete walls is the retaining wall. The glue lamp beams in the ceiling are the structure, and the sports floor is the sports floor. And then at night, we've integrated all the lighting so that it gets like a rather cozy atmosphere. It's like dimly lit, and only the social spaces glow, so you sort of almost naturally know where to gravitate towards. So again, like this sort of very basic idea where it's really the parameters of the sport that has sort of created the shape. A last project that we just got approved in Denmark also deals with this refurbishment of abandoned infrastructure. In this case, it's the fortification of the west coast of Europe, built by the Germans during the occupation. And they have left behind these like virtually indestructible concrete bunkers. One of them was a gun turret on the west coast of Denmark. The gun was manufactured by Krupps in Germany and had been sent to Denmark, and it was going to be installed in September 1945. Happily, that never became necessary because the war ended. And on this place in the dunes, the gun turret still sits. And we got commissioned to do a museum telling the story, the history of the bunkers, a local history museum, a museum of amber, and an art museum. So essentially, it's 4 mini museums in one building. And it's going to be like right next to the bunker that's already like this landmark in the dunes on the west coast. So our idea was to make it almost as an inverse bunker, sort of hide it inside the dunes, so the 4 museums, one gallery for each, becomes like this knot on the network of paths. So when you look at the site, it's almost like a completely invisible museum. When you arrive, all you see is the bunker, and as you go closer, you see these little incisions that will take you to a sunken courtyard that brings daylight and entrances into the museum galleries themselves. And finally, like the bunker museum has a corridor that connects into the existing bunker itself. And because the gun was never installed, it has this big hollow space where the machinery for turning the gun was supposed to be present. And we were thinking, like, a way to tell the story about the bunker. We're suggesting to install this spiral stair that takes you to the center of the circle. We found the blueprints of the gun and thought maybe we could make sort of almost like a wireframe version. So we suggested almost as an art piece to make a glass cannon that sort of completely creates the size and the geometry of the gun, so you can really understand what this was. It wasn't a safety bunker, it was like a weapon. And then actually the two gun turrets become giant binoculars, and because of the sheer magnitude of the two turrets, they can actually see 55 kilometers, which was the range of the cannon. So basically by going up into the gun, you can sort of sit there and like turn the gun around and really understand what was the role of this piece of infrastructure in the conflict of the Second World War. So happily, we a private foundation said that they would sponsor and pay for the whole project. The only thing they don't want to pay for is the gun. So we have to really sort of frame it as an art project, because they don't want anybody to say that they're paying money for building German guns. But essentially, almost the only visible landmark of the project becomes this ghost of a gun that was never installed. So this whole notion of infrastructure, sometimes you can reinvent existing infrastructure to create new purposes. But the last two examples that I have somehow deal with this idea of trying to sort of maybe create cultural and social programs that actually function as infrastructure. One is we got invited to do an art museum in a sculpture park in Norway. And basically, the sculpture park was on two sides of the river. And we thought maybe the bridge, or maybe the museum, could actually be the bridge that would solve the circulation and turn the whole sculpture park visit into a single loop. So very simply, the museum connects a flat part on one side to a steep slope on the other side. So the geometry of the bridge transforms to accommodate the level changes. A single skylight turns into a panoramic window. You enter on the path. The path continues through the exhibition. Three layers of galleries. And where the building turns, it becomes this fanning stair that connects all three galleries. The top gallery is skylit, and then it sort of turns 90 degrees and becomes this panoramic view of the existing mill that is further down the river. So in a way, you can say that the building becomes almost like a hybrid between a museum, a bridge, and a sculpture in its own right. You can even see it as the biggest sculpture in the sculpture park. And depending on where you see it, you won't really understand if it is a building or if it is just a really big sculpture along the other pieces. And maybe as a last intermezzo, because I think that brings us to this sort of notion of social infrastructure. Maybe another aspect of architecture is that it's almost impossible for an architect to have, because of our absence of financial and political power, we can't really choose what we get to do. But sometimes, if you're persistent enough, fate will find you. In 2007, we had an exhibition at the storefront, Gallery for Art and Architecture in New York, and the project we exhibited was this giant model made out of Lego, because we had won a competition to design something called the Lego Towers in Copenhagen. It looked like it was designed and built out of Lego, so we got Lego to donate a quarter of a million Lego pieces and 2,000 Lego people. So we completely went to town and built this like insane Lego model. Also, it left this sort of army of residue in our office, so we have tons of Lego everywhere. You see Lego pieces. All our signage in the office is built out of Lego. So it became this sort of almost unhealthy obsession for the office. And actually, if you talk about the highest honor you can get in architecture, I think one of them is that I noticed recently that in the Lego flagship store in Copenhagen, they actually have unsanctioned built a copy of our harbor bath in the store. Sadly, the Lego towers never got materialized because of the financial crisis in 2008. So the project died, and we never got to realize it. But then sort of a year ago, we got contacted by Lego itself and got a chance to make a proposal for this like Lego experience building in Billund, where Lego is from. And just to show how important Lego is in Denmark, and in, especially in this city, they are tearing down the city hall and building this Lego building instead. But maybe since Lego, more than anyone, has found the amazing art of visual communication, that they can actually make incredibly complex structures that they can explain to like six-year-olds how to put together using only illustrations. I'm going to try to sort of copy them and only explain the project with this this little film we did.
We'll be right back.
This is also going to be like one of the first pieces of architecture where you have to make no adjustments to the design whatsoever to be able to make it out of Lego. But in some way, like after sort of 7 years of trying, we finally got to do a building that is really all about Lego. The last project I wanted to show you is somehow, I think, sums up a lot of our aspirations and a lot of the things we've discovered in the last decade of having our own practice. And it might be the landmark of Copenhagen in 2016. It's right on the waterfront of Copenhagen, right? This is the opera, this is the Royal Theater, this is downtown. But it's not going to be like a cultural palace or even a royal palace. It's going to be a power plant that turns trash into electricity and district heating. So 3 kilos of household trash turns into 4 hours of electricity and 5 hours of heating. And if you look at trash as a resource, a ton of trash equals 1 2/3 of a barrel of oil. But this power plant, like these kinds of power plants, are ugly boxes. This is going to be the tallest and biggest building in Copenhagen. So we sort of try to ask ourselves, how can we sort of make this, design this in such a way that it becomes an asset for the community rather than this sort of ugly box that blocks the views and casts shadows on its neighbors. It's going to be right next to Copenhagen Marina, and it's going to be right next to where the local boys go water skiing. And speaking of skiing, Danes love to ski. We actually have snow, but we have, as you saw earlier, no topography whatsoever. So we thought we might not have mountains, but we have mountains of trash. So we can actually go to Isabel in the south of Sweden. It takes like 5 or 6 hours by car. But we can actually do 2/3 of Isabel, surely because of the magnitude of this building. We have a vertical drop of 100 meters. So we know how big the machines are going to be, so we create a continuous roof slope. And instead of making a traditional visitor center where school teachers drag the children to force them to listen to how waste turns into energy, we are installing an elevator that takes you to a green, a blue, and a black ski slope. Miraculously, we won the competition based on this idea. So from 2016, you have to look out for the Danish skiers and alpine skiing, because now we can actually practice at home. And actually, since then, we stole the idea from the ski resorts, but since then we actually stole the idea back, and we're also doing a ski hotel in Lapland in the north of Finland that's designed so that all of the roofs of the hotels are actually the beginning of the slope. So it's like this little version of ski in, ski out, that you can actually take the elevator from the main lobby out and ski into the resort. But sort of back in Copenhagen, we actually broke ground. We're building the building. The facades are made out of these prefabricated aluminum planters that have vegetation almost like the side of a cliff. They also filter daylight into the workspaces. And you say, I started showing this image that shows like this idea of creating all of our cities and buildings as giant man-made ecosystems. And with this project, we are very close to sort of realizing such a vision, because not only does the building locally harvest the resources, the rainwater for the facade, natural daylight, the chimney effect for natural ventilation, but also together with the city of Copenhagen, it creates a giant man-made metabolism where waste becomes resource. It's also going to be the cleanest waste-to-energy power plant in the world. The smoke that comes out of the chimney is going to be completely non-toxic, but it's still going to contain a certain amount of CO2. So we worked together with Realities United out of Berlin to make this art project where the CO2 accumulates in the mouth of the chimney, and when there's 200 kilos, it puffs a gigantic smoke ring. And of course, on one hand, it's the ultimate artistic expression of hedonistic sustainability, that what used to be a toxic problem has now become something harmless and playful, because it is non-toxic, but it does contain the CO2. So I think more importantly, back to this idea of knowledge-driven design, that you can say one of the main parameters, or like one of the main drivers of behavioral change is knowledge, that if people don't know, they can't act. Understanding and knowledge always precedes action. And the problem about CO2 emissions is that nobody understands what it is. Like a ton of CO2, nobody can grasp it. It's this like completely abstract thing. I think this is almost like one of the great powers of architecture, is that you can turn the abstract concrete. From 2016, if you come and visit Copenhagen, all you have to do is count the smoke rings in the sky. And when you counted five of them, you know exactly what is one ton of CO2. So I think sort of almost as an ending note, you can say if one of the powers of architecture and art is to turn these abstract and almost like invisible aspects of life into concrete facts that sort of change our perception of the world or even change our world in the case of architecture, a project like the power plant, I think, will be changing in the sense that today it sounds like crazy to go skiing on the roof of a power plant, but from 2016, that's just how they do it in Copenhagen, and everybody can refer to it, and I think it's going to open up a lot of doors for making other kinds of socially proactive pieces of infrastructure. And then I also think this idea of, you know, one of the ways to really create a certain awareness is that this is going to be a very environmentally progressive building, but it still emits CO2. So rather than making a secret, it's being projected onto the Copenhagen skies and will be there so that everybody understands what is the CO2 footprint of their lifestyle in Copenhagen, because all they have to do is look at the sky and they know exactly what the sort of the consequences of our consumption is. So thank you.
So thank you, Bjarke, for an amazing lecture. I can say that having heard every Israeli lecture since the beginning, that your lecture counts as one of the most pleasant and intelligent one. So adding from to Anne-Marie's comment at the beginning that Bjarke is one of the youngest star architects, I would say that he's also one of the most intelligent one. He's known as a rock star of architecture and as a maker of icons, but I was struck with what simplicity and ease he can explain how, from a program, a site, he can actually playfully engage the people and the landscape in a very smooth way. And I also was thinking about David Israeli, hearing him speak, and that I would think that he would also agree with the kind of logic and simplicity that Bjark bring to his work, meanwhile creating these wonderful, playful, cheerful, iconic buildings. So thank you very much. I will now open the floor for questions. I think we are organized so that we have two mics. This is amazing, the view from here. I wish there was always so many people at our lectures. So we have two mics. So we can start. Yeah.
You stated that although architects have limited economic and political clout, they do have the power of ideas. And indeed, your project indicates great creativity of yourself and a few like-minded people. Unfortunately, this doesn't apply to the vast majority of humanity. who live and work under terrible conditions. What, if anything, can be done to ameliorate that situation?
I think the vast majority of those challenges are not necessarily architectural. So I think there's a lot of creativity that needs to be applied in other aspects of society than perhaps architecture. I think one of the things that you can say that we are currently quite interested in is that this idea of social infrastructure, this idea of proactive beneficial social side effects of major infrastructural investments into industry or other aspects of infrastructure, I think can actually be applied intelligently in a developing world context where you have, Denmark is the most socially equal country in the world. So the difference between the richest and the poorest is the least. A lot of developing countries have very different economic demographics. So you can say in certain developing countries, a small part of the population holds a great part of the key to the economic prosperity of the country. And therefore, certain investments into infrastructure will immediately only benefit a smaller part of the population, but it is necessary for the country as a whole to be realized. And quite often, these investments have only negative social side effects, like a highway that cuts an informal settlement in half. And I think these kind of investments that are made with like millions or billions of dollars, like investments of such a magnitude that they could easily be conceived in such a way that they would actually have positive social side effects, that they could accommodate passing or even accommodate certain programs as part of their realization in a similar way that the power plant in Copenhagen creates a ski park on its roof. You could imagine that this notion of social infrastructure could actually be applied quite intelligently in a developing world.
Thank you. I was talking with my students earlier today about some of your work. Sorry, I was talking with some of my students earlier today about your work, even showed the New York project. But one thing that I was talking to them with regard to the idea of how you work in terms of diagrams. Can you talk a little bit about that, how you work with regard to diagrams? I think a lot of students would be interested.
I think communication is a very important tool in architecture. My old Danish teacher used to say that if you don't write clearly, it's because you don't think clearly. When she gave the Danish essays back. And I think that is quite true in the sense that certain art forms, you can deal with them on a purely intuitive level, but because the essence of architecture is that it's so collaborative that like for any project, like I think we've been 15 people team on West 57, and I think over the last 3 years we've been maybe like 30 people in and out of the project. And there's like all of the collaborators, all of the consultants, the clients, and all of the clients' consultants, the city officials, the city architect, the Department of City Planning, the whole public process of an urban land use and rezoning process. So like in the end, and then finally all of the contractors that are going to realize it, and the financiers that are going to pay for it, and the real estate people that are going to lease it or rent it out. To do anything as an architect, you have to like tap into the specific knowledge of this like army of different fields of input. And also in order to get to realize the project, you have to persuade everybody that this is actually, you know, not only what you want, but also what they want. So therefore, to not drown in the complexities of all these aspects, finding ways of turning these abstract criteria into concrete facts is a major part of being able to keep an overview. And also, it contains an element of empowerment that traditionally architects, I've heard architects criticized as being crypto-fascists, like people that try to retain power by making absolutely no sense, because if nobody understands what they're saying, it has to be very complicated and intelligent. And I think when you become very explicit and very objective and concrete about the criteria behind a project and the information that informs your design decisions, you cease to have monopoly of understanding the project. Everybody else will understand it. They'll also be able to see certain flaws, and they'll be able to contribute with criticism and even suggestions. And suddenly, and I think for architecture, it's very important in the design process that every single team member within the office and outside the office understands what are the criteria, what are the problems, what are the potentials that we're trying to materialize here, so that they can actually be active participants. And you don't get this bottleneck. Now I have 200 colleagues, mostly in two offices, that if I became this bottleneck that, where, you know, I only was working with sort of a bunch of executive morons that was waiting for my genius sketch to solve every single problem, we would it would be a terrible situation. Whereas now everybody always knows exactly what is this project all about, and a major element in our collaboration is to constantly reiterate what are the key criteria, why is the project like this, and therefore everybody can keep continuing. And when you encounter new obstacles, everybody knows the priorities and can actually contribute to making intelligent suggestions.
So you use the diagrams more for communication to others as opposed to designing with
Internally, it's a major element in constantly summing up what the project is all about. And then I think, you know, a major part of the project is also that we do, you know, we do maybe hundreds of models for a single project. Sometimes we're lucky and we nail it in the first sketch. The Vancouver Tower was one meeting, one sketch, and then like 50 models that look exactly the same but test proportions and other things. But sometimes it's this like quite violent effort, and a major part of it is like diagrams or 3D models. So in that sense, it's not like we, after the fact, try to reconstruct what the story was. It's actually going forward that each diagram is a paragraph in the overall argument.
You did mention the Canadian element in your red square. Do you remember? Remember what the Canadian one was?
There is a Canadian element. There's 120 objects. Let me chew on it. But there is actually one, for sure. Probably some silly bench. I'm not sure. But there is one, like, God damn it. We're coming out with a book, Super Keeling, that contains every single element, but I'm going to investigate.
I'm curious, as a Dane, how are you going to solve the new skiing mountain you're going to do in Denmark outside when we don't have that much snow all the time during the year? That's when you talk about this sustainable aspect. How are you going to solve this? Because it is a playful thought. Danes are really interested in skiing, but we have maybe 10 or 15 days of snow each year.
Well, actually, we last year, There was actually 6 months with snowfall, but of course, it doesn't stay that long. But we have night frost for almost, like sometimes up to 5 months. We actually have frost at night, which is the condition for spraying reclaimed water up to come down as snow. But then one of the things we're looking at is like in the summer, it's going to be a BMX bicycle facility. And then we are looking at having this turf. There's different kind of like existing products. Actually, in Virginia, there's a big artificial outdoor ski slope with a kind of AstroTurf. So we have various samples, and we are looking into the idea that it can be supplemented because that would be able to extend the season.
So you're counting on using the actual snow that comes once in a while in Denmark, or do you have to add on maybe some of the months when we have a lot of rain?
When you have frost at night, you the way a snow cannon works is that you spray like vaporized water into the air, and then it comes down as snow. So we would definitely look into using that, but it requires no active cooling, just that you collect the water that falls as rain. And like in a large part of the winter, you'll have rainfall during the day, and then it freezes at night. So you just tap it during the day and spray it up during the night.
Hi, over here. Aside from the Lego model that you showed us, everything that all the projects that you showed were digitally rendered or digitally represented, do you work with physical models to explore your designs, or do you focus mainly on the digital representation?
I think I showed quite a few physical models, actually. But they're so well made that you thought they were renders. We do work like constantly with model and like big models. Most projects come with humongous models.
I meant like conceptually. Do you work on your concepts through models, or do you work on your concepts using digital media?
I think every media has its. I think Jan can testify that we make a ridiculous amount of sketch models. But I think a lot of the process is that, you know, you have a conversation, you scribble down some sketches, they go into the computer as drawings, and then either we 3D print the stuff out or we build it out of foam blocks. Then you have another round of conversations around those models, and then it goes through the same process. So I think it's a bit like each medium has certain opportunities and certain limitations. And I think the physical model has the advantage that it's there in the space. And in that sense, it's incredibly available for like blatant observation and manipulation.
So what do you start with when you're looking at, you know, coming up with the design?
I just said. Well, you know, a little bit of both, but like sometimes you know the first conversation is around, like typically the team will prepare like some like non-propositional models, like this is the building envelope, this is how much the area would look like if you would make it as a stupid square, this is the typical way to do it, like a housing slab or a perimeter block or like sort of. So that everybody gets it's a way of quantifying, and again making the, because like things that you can't see are like unknowns, but as soon as you turn something into a concrete fact or concrete model, you get an intuitive understanding, this is how much it's going to be, and so we can, you know, if we put it like this, it's going to block the views of these guys, so they can just be sort of conversation starters. So I would say, like, in any typical project, we do 100 concept models before we are home.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I personally like some of your projects in terms of view and their big concepts, but I'm an architect too, but about 10 years of working on solar architecture. And the problem I see in particular one of your projects, which is New York Tower, is that when you such projects, if you design a single building in a desert, you can optimize your form in order to give more sun during the winter, and therefore you can optimize the form of the building. But when you design a city, the situation is completely different. You should consider the effect of your building on the urban fabric. Therefore, I'm quite sure, and I see this problem with that particular building, that your building creates a big shade during the winter for the city. And what do you see this kind of things? Because most of the time you are working inside your building for your clients, but you have also some responsibilities for the city. Certainly you are considering these facts, but in terms of solar radiation and having the sun for everyone in the city, it's really important, and it was that important that I just mentioned it here. Thanks.
I mean, specifically that project, the main shadow is falling on the power plant that is north of the site. So, of course, in any ULURP process, you go through an excessive public process where one of the things you demonstrate is the shadow impact on the surroundings, and it's quite the optimal, simply because the majority of the shadow falls on the power plant.
Thank you. One last question. Okay, there's a question down over there.
Yeah. I'm a master's student here studying architecture. Thanks so much for the presentation. This question actually might tie in a little bit with the last question, and it has to do with your critics. And I'm wondering, maybe it's a little bit personal, but I'm curious as to, obviously you've taught at many different schools and you have a highly successful firm. How do you deal with, or do you pay attention to, perhaps other designers, people in the profession, in academia, saying that, maybe you're not doing things right, or, they're not exactly for the work that you do. Do you pay attention to that? If so, how do you respond to that?
I think, especially in architecture, you can't do anything without attracting a lot of antagonism. I think, there is a tremendous amount of hate blogging on architecture websites, because I think people that have time for blogging. I think whenever we encounter informed criticism, it's quite welcomed. I think often it's not. And I think, but whenever it's there, in that sense, our approach to architecture is not based on some preconceived stylistic preference, whatever. Like, it is very sort of idea based, and therefore it is debatable based on the parameters that we put forward. And therefore, I think our work is quite open for discussion. But I think the majority of the criticism I see is quite often uninformed. Like these editors that did a book called Clock, the first it was like dedicated to criticizing, and it was sort of, I would say, like 50% praise and 50% bashing. But then one of them, the chief editor, he made a review of some of our work, the mountain and the eight house, and then they gave it to me so I could respond, and so I saw the different articles, and then I asked him if he had been to see our buildings, and the whole and he had never. So and his whole statement was that when you go there, there's no surprise beyond the image and the diagram. But he had never been there to experience that. So after that, he actually went and he didn't change a comma in his essay. So but at least he could say that he had been. So I think in that sense, especially in with the sort of instantaneity of. An omnipresence of you know, projects, imagery, and discussions in the internet area. It is quite rare that that criticism is incredibly informed, but when it is, it's almost always helpful in one way or the other.
Thank you very much. Please welcome to thank again, Jacques.